Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Open Observability Talks. I'm your host, Dotan Horvitz, and here at Open Observability Talks, we talk about anything DevOps, observability, and open source. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Logs.io, the cloud-native observability platform. Logs.io takes the best-of-breed open source projects, such as Prometheus, OpenSearch, Jaeger, OpenTelemetry, and similar, and offers them as a unified observability platform built for scale. For those joining the live stream on YouTube or Twitch, feel free to share questions and comments on the chat. And if you're not joining the live stream, do know that we have the live stream and you're more than welcome to join one of these. It makes things much more fun. And let's move on to today's episode. In this episode, I want to look into platform engineering. As a veteran of PaaS, platform as a service, I personally find it intriguing to see the current increasing excitement about platform engineering. Even surprisingly, Gartner featured it in its hype cycle for software engineering. And some people claim it's the next stage in the evolution of DevOps. Some say it's the future of ops, all sorts of these claims. So I decided to look into that and see what platform engineering is really about. My guest for this topic has established platform engineering in a very large company. He's the director of cloud platform engineering at Citrix. And on his spare time has been writing about the topic a lot, even some rumors of a book. And lecturing about this topic on many distinguished stages and forums, and actually now joining me from HashiConf, I'd like to invite George Hantzaras to stage. Hey, George, how you doing?
Hey, Dotan. I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
Name properly, by the way.
Yeah. It was good.
Great. So first of all, thanks a lot for taking the time there. I'm sure you have a busy schedule there at HashiConf. How does it look like this year?
It's interesting up to now. I had the opportunity yesterday to kind of see some interesting stuff. Today there were a lot of product roadmap presentations, which is always interesting to see. So interesting stuff. My presentation was also yesterday. That went well. Most interesting, I think, was that, you know, that the conference is growing a lot. It was, I think, the first year that it was four different tracks, which is means it's a huge thing for the conference. Many, many, many people. Great stuff. Great being close to the community.
Yeah, amazing to see. And I know that you personally are involved in the user group there in Athens, right? As yep. Part of your off-work topics that you're passionate about.
Yeah. And we haven't yet organized a big event in Athens, but we will. We have to organize a big HashiCorp event there.
Sounds good. So let's jump straight to the topic. And let's start with the basics. We have DevOps, we have SRE. So what are we missing? Why do we even need platform engineering?
Yeah, that's usually a good starting point when someone starts thinking, you know, do I need platform engineering or is it just a hype? That's always a good starting point. Why move from DevOps or you know, these kind of practices? Why start adopting a platform engineering approach? And the difference is that platform engineering doesn't, you know. So DevOps uses the tools to provide an end result, to, you know, automate things, streamline deployments, all this kind of stuff. Now platform takes all those tools and it productizes it. So it's an easier way for you to kind of replicate best practices. It's an easier way to kind of scale these best practices in larger organizations.
And I assume that usually these organizations, when you talk about scale, then lots of different teams, with at least the ones that I know, the big organization, then you have different runtimes and different, you know, CI/CD pipelines existing, different deployment methods. So how platform engineering fits within all this diversity that usually exists in these large organizations?
Yeah, that's a good question also, because when you start building a platform, usually, you know, if you see someone's DevOps journey, platform kind of comes towards the end. So a lot of people have already best practices in place, as you said, different CI/CD, automation, infrastructure as code, all those things are there. So that's what we call platform as product. So you should kind of treat the platform as a product. You should have regular, traditional product management, and make sure that you treat other engineers as customers. So make sure you go out there, see what problems they have, try to understand the landscape within the engineering community and the company, and then try to see how you can facilitate that in the best way. Teams are going to be using observability tools, teams are going to be using different release tools, and you have to find a way to productize this approach while facilitating different tooling.
So let's learn a bit maybe more about, you're the director of cloud platform engineering at Citrix, as I mentioned. So maybe tell us a bit about your team and how it's structured at Citrix.
So we do a few different things as a cloud platform engineering team. We do a few different things. So the cloud platform engineering team historically has tried a lot of stuff. We initially tried to build what we thought were the best practices and try to build our product with our own roadmap. Then we had to shift, and it was a learning journey. Now I'm here talking about how you should listen to the engineering community, but we weren't always doing that as a platform team. So so now we've ended up at the place where we build tools to facilitate, to kind of improve and promote faster adoption of cloud native technologies and make the cloud a more secure place for developers to deploy, to try out new stuff, all those kind of things. And that kind of means facilitating all different needs and the observability use case. We've talked a bit about this, we can go into a bit more details, is a good journey how you can facilitate this multitude of technologies and this diverse landscape.
Yeah. And just to complete the picture so that people understand, it's not that product engineering replaces DevOps and SRE. You do have them in the organization. So maybe can you complete the picture on how that how these are structured within Citrix?
Yeah. So normally what would happen is each different product development team would have their own SREs. I think this is one of the things that Citrix does really well. SRE is done in the original traditional Google way. Software background, really good coding skills, people who are really good software engineers but understand systems and are there to reduce toil and automate and embed reliability in the products. Those are the people who are gonna, those are our customers. This is the first person we're gonna start interacting. They take care of integrating tooling, they take care of infrastructure matters. So we have to go and convince them. We start having a normal discussion, try to sell our platform components. Then we would normally start with a POC in lower environments, and then we would roll it out in a small portion and then expand in the whole footprint of their application. So it's the regular sales life cycle anyone would see.
The SREs, as you said, are embedded within the product teams, and they're your sort of counterparts and maybe primary customers or champions in the product teams, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly. So the SREs are our main interface in the product teams, yes.
And you touched a bit about the DevOps journey, and this is something that I've been when I hear people claim it's the next stage in DevOps evolution and things like that. When I tried to look into that beyond just a soundbite, I approached it like an engineer. So I went into the DevOps maturity models and that maps the DevOps journey, let's say. And the classic journey as they show it goes from initial to repeatable to define to manage to optimize. It's like usually it's around these types of evolved skills. So where in that maturity model do you see the missing pieces, or where does the platform engineering fit And is it really the next stage in the evolution, as some people claim?
Yeah. So if you look any DevOps maturity model out there, it starts with the initial stage, which where you don't have any DevOps practices. Then you start with managed, where you just start applying DevOps. Then you move to defined, where DevOps best practices start to take shape, and then measured and optimized, where you start to promote best practices across different teams. So where platform engineering would fit is, so you start with managed and defined. So each team does their own thing, but then what you can do as you grow and as you're working in a bigger organization, in order to move to the measured and the optimized phases, this is where you can start. First you kind of get into the measured. You try to understand what you're try to collect data points. You understand the impact of DevOps in your software development life cycle, and then in order to optimize and scale, that's where platform engineering comes in. So it's kind of the next step in the journey with the with a condition that we're talking about the large enough engineering population. Large enough doesn't mean Citrix wide, where we're talking about thousands of engineers, but you should at least have a few Scrum teams and a few DevOps engineers doing the same thing.
Yeah, and I think the repeatable piece, I think, becomes very crucial when you have such large organizations. So when people look for the justification within the DevOps maturity model, I at least found that the repeatable piece becomes the reinventing the wheel every time with a different team. That's where, when you do that at scale, becomes really wasteful, and obviously has additional downsides. But that's where you really feel that it's a clear signal usually that you need to start considering it.
Yeah, and there's a joke I always say about platform engineering. When they ask me what is platform engineering, I usually say it's what happens when DevOps engineers start talking to each other. And what that means is essentially that you have different teams, usually, even in cross-functional teams, those would be closed from one another, and you would have DevOps engineers solving the same problem again and again. But then if you have those people starting collaborating, they could start optimizing and solving the same problem once for both teams.
Yeah, I have to admit, and I said it also in the opening of the episode, that this, when I started seeing this buzz around platform engineering, it gave me flashbacks from the days of PaaS. And I think you're veteran enough to remember that as I do, when we used to divide the universe into IaaS, infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, and then software as a service. And we thought everything would fall very neatly into this three-tier model approach. And then, obviously, very popular platforms as a service came out, like Heroku back then was a very, very popular one. And the cloud providers started offering managed version. AWS had the Beanstalk and Google App Engine and things like that. And obviously, it's no longer the case. So I'm wondering, from your perspective as an industry veteran, how is that different now?
Well, you're right. This has kind of evolved, and we can no longer think about, we have, infrastructure as a service is this small box, and then platform as a service is the other box, and they don't touch each other. And even if you look inside platform engineering, there are different levels of it, and different teams, different organizations handle it in a different way. So, you can have teams focusing in what I would normally call like the core platform, which is like runtime, Kubernetes infrastructure, release pipelines, those kind of things. Other organizations might focus on, adding on top of that, adding services to do secrets management, certificate management, maybe add some tools to do automated DR drills, chaos engineering, those kind of things. And nowadays you even see people considering platform engineering what we would, like 3 years back, we would call SaaS engineering, which is essentially shared platform components within the same company. So, you know, like billing, metering, cloud account management, cloud authorization for the customers. So things that you would use across different products, but start slowly to embed business logic. So that's where it kind of starts to become a bit gray. What I have been focusing on is on kind of the lower levels. And the approach is, if you can take the service and you can give it in another product team, if you can even give it in another company and they can use it right away, then, you know, that's core platform and that's what we should be doing.
That makes sense. And I think one other thing that I found is that in the, I guess, past days, it was very much, it's a very opinionated way of trying to consolidate on a platform that I think even back then was not trivial. And as the environments diversified, it became more challenging to have a single platform to rule them all in a very strict manner. So I think the approach with platform engineering, first of all, it's internal to the organization. It's not Heroku off the shelf that I'm trying to enforce on my organization, but rather I build with my own platform engineering. That's the important, the engineering part of platform engineering being that it is part of my engineering. So I build based on what my organization needs, my best practices, my org structure and other constraints. And secondly, I think it's softer in a sense than the opinionated platform. So as you started touching when you said that you're doing something, when you talked about the relationship with the counterpart on the product team, and you said that you need to persuade them and to work with them and to bring the benefit, I think this is something that is a softer approach and a more gradual approach. You don't tell them, okay, you need to go all in. You can provide a more gradual approach, which is something that I find more sustainable in these diverse environments and organizations.
And you start seeing also the tooling providers kind of take the same direction. So, and you know, I'm kind of going to bring you some of the discussions of the conference. So we had yesterday, there were a couple of presentations about HashiCorp Waypoint, which is their new tool where you can kind of streamline deployments and you are able to provide a PaaS-like experience, but you know it's really early, so you have to build a few stuff around it in order to call it a PaaS. And we had, so after these presentations, it happened. So we had some discussions with some reporters, and they were actually reporting for Waypoint specifically. And the question was, why, you know, Heroku versus Waypoint? Why Waypoint versus, you know, like Cloud Foundry in the old days or OpenShift? And you know, that the answer was that you want tools that are going to give you flexibility and are not really strongly opinionated. You kind of have to find the sweet spot, so you're not just doing DevOps work ad hoc for each different teams, but your tool should allow you to kind of build different experiences and you know, kind of have a more pluggable architecture where you can just write a different plugin and it's ready for the next team, or you know, convert, you know, just add an API endpoint and you're done, you know, one more team is on board. So you have to have this kind of flexibility. And the tools, you know, back a few years back, you know, if you look at Heroku and those things, were almost, you know, they were dictating how you're going to do anything in the deployment and you know, that's the big difference.
Yeah, I definitely agree there. And I don't know, maybe perhaps it's my background as a product manager for dev platforms, but one of the most powerful things I believe in is to treat the platform as a product. And you mentioned that you do that too at Citrix. So how do you practice this platform as a product at Citrix?
Well, it's for a platform team, it's kind of hard to make to be sure that you don't go, you know, back to being, you know, just a group of DevOps people doing different stuff. So you have to, but it's also, you know, you can't go all the way over at the other side because you're not solving the problems that people have. You're solving the problems that you think they have. And that's the most fundamental thing is, you know, if you were to go and build, you know, software for an airline company, you would have to understand what the needs are for the businesses, what the needs of the industry are. You wouldn't just go in a room, start coding, and you're like, oh, what I would like this to be. Okay, let's code that in. I have no idea what the airline industry looks like, but that's my opinion. So if you treat it that way, you're going to have the issue of adoption. So you're going to build something teams don't want to use. On the way other side, you know, if you just address the team's needs and you just do firefighting, you're not going to have a product. So you have to be somewhere in the middle, build the core product that solves the problems that most teams have, but make it extensible enough to facilitate other teams. And that's where product management comes on board. That's where you should go out there, collect requirements the right way, gather as much data points as you can, so you can see, you know, if they're having issues with releases, if they don't release often enough, if their change failure rate is really high, if their SLIs aren't looking good. So you try to collect data points and try to understand the problem, but also listen to what they're saying.
I think it's there are two elements here. One, I think, because many people jump straight to the tooling and, you know, choose the best of breed tool and things like that. But I think there's a very strong element. You know, they always say that three P's. So I'm saying that the P's of people and also processes is something very important. So the cultural element that you need to instill to get the adoption of the platform is something that I think is very is very prominent. You started touching when you mentioned that you're how you engage with the product team. Maybe you can say a bit more about how you generate this buy-in with the product teams.
Well, we usually the way we do that is, you know, back you know, going back to my startup days and what we would do in order to convince someone to buy our software. It was, you know, it was the exact same thing. You would start talking, try to understand what their problem was, go have a demo, then, you know, start talking about architecture, some documents, go back and forth. Then you would start with a POC, and then you would expand, you would deploy something in production. You know, if we are talking about, you know, you have a service that does secrets or certificates management, you would deploy that managing 10% of their secrets. That would work well. Next iteration, you would do like 50% of their secrets, and you would slowly expand. So it's exactly like going out there to sell your software.
I think this is a great example, because it goes back to what we said before, that you need to have a soft entrance point, and also something that some of the platforms did less well. Some of the platforms did it better in the traditional platforms like Cloud Foundry, that it's modular enough that people can gain benefit even if they take one or two pieces even out of the full suite. And even though you, as the one behind, you know how much more that can gain if they take the full suite, they still see very clear, very immediate benefit and very focused benefit by taking one piece, and then you can grow. You can grow in the usage of that specific piece in other parts, and also obviously then add other layers of the platform where they interface with that piece, and then you sort of land and expand sort of a strategy that allows for much softer and gradual entry with very clear benefits in each step of the adoption.
Yeah, and throughout this process, it's really important to kind of, you know, have the engineers with the right soft skills. So the platform engineering and platform adoption has a lot to do with soft skills. You know, us engineers, we are usually, I think, strongly opinionated. And you have to be able to go out there, try to talk to someone that is interested in adopting the platform, and you might face a bad architecture, bad tooling, some wrong decisions in their product, and you have to be okay with it. You're not going to tell them to change the whole thing. No one's going to invest 1,000 story points because you say so. You are there to facilitate, solve, you know, a well-bounded problem, and, you know, then you have to be okay with them doing their thing. So there are a lot of aspects, you know, on the soft side as well.
And on the other end, I think that quantifying that, you mentioned no one will invest 1,000 story points to integrate with you, but then again, showing the benefit also in the same way, saying, look at maybe a reference of another team within the organization that you saved. I think you gave me this example in one of the cases to say, we saved you 250 story points by taking ownership of this and this piece that before they used to do themselves. This is something very tangible that shows the value. So you're also working very, very measured way to show the benefit, right?
Yeah. And that's the part where you can start making your life easier. So, you know, going back to the example, if you have a service that rotates certificates and secrets, if you go back and, you know, this is a real story, you know, I go back and I look in the backlog of the team, everything that they have implemented in the past, and try to see what toil they have invested in order to rotate secrets, plus all the toil and all the manual work you have to track secrets in Excel files. And, you know, I've seen a few different things in different companies being done the wrong way around this. And, you know, if you tell them you were investing 300 story points a year, and now you just invested 50 story points integrated with the service and you're done, then, you know, that's going to be a good use case for you to go to the next product team and keep on selling that.
Yeah. And going back to the platform as a product, again, this is a passion of mine. So just understand, so you have a dedicated product owners, product managers for the platform. How did you structure that in that respect?
So, we have the notion of the Epic owners and the business owners. So, generally the culture we try to have is that if you have an idea, you know, no matter if you're an intern or the director of the team, you just bring it in the backlog grooming session, you present this, and if it's good and you make the business case for it, then you're the Epic owner for this. You're responsible for driving architecture, driving the implementation. Now, one of the things you have to do is you have to convince one of the business owners to be with you so he can go out there and talk with adopters, talk with, you know, with the external stakeholders and help you drive the product roadmap. So these are the key personas that kind of drive the process. And then, you know, we kind of have the product management role, and we have the system architect role, and that's kind of how we evaluate all these things. But when you bring the business case, when a new Epic owner wants to bring a business case and wants to present, you know, a new feature, a new tool, anything, it's not just about, you know, this is the right thing to do, this is the right technology, all those things. You have to actually say, this team is interested, this team is losing some, you know, this amount of toil, this team is having these security incidents. You know, you have to actually show us where the business value is within the company. And that's when this can go in the backlog.
Interesting. So in your case, you don't have one product manager for the platform. You have each and every team member can act as a product owner for a specific feature or something like that.
Well, I kind of operate as a product manager of the platform as well. So I kind of wear different hats, but that only happens, you know, when we reach a point where we do the prioritization and scoring and we prioritize the existing backlog. That's the only point in time where the product manager shows up. When we create the backlog and we gather requirements and score everything and stuff, that's when it's a bit more decentralized.
Interesting. And another point that I'm curious to hear your thoughts is the data-driven approach. You know, product management comes, I'm talking about, you know, regular client, end user products. Obviously are very much data driven, but then it's quite easy. Usually you tie to top line like ARR, things like that. What would be the equivalence or the metrics in place in the case of a platform?
Well, it always kind of goes back to why the platform exists. So the platform is there in order to help teams to release faster. So reduce time to market for new features. It's there to improve developer experience. It's there to improve reliability, and it's there to kind of propagate best practices. So having those in mind, it's kind of easy to think of the KPI. So if you think about reliability, the KPIs would be improving SLI, improving availability of the service, improving customer availability. So SLIs for specific customer user journeys. If we're talking about developer productivity, we can see stuff early, you know, as early on in the process, we can start looking at PR lead time, time to first review, those kind of things, all the way, you know, to the pipeline metrics, DORA metrics, those kind of things. And then developer experience, that's where, you know, this can be based on other metrics, engagement scores, feedback from the teams. So it's a few different things, but it all kind of comes down to why did you start the platform team? What are you looking to get? And it's usually developer experience, time to market, reliability, and best practices, security, those kind of things.
Which are the core ones, but for each tool, the new tool that you release or new feature, you attach its respective metrics to for the success for that specific capability, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you should start. You know, we have, you know, both leading and lagging indicators. So you should have the leading indicators are going to tell you right out of the door, are you probably going to do good? And then the lagging indicators are going to come and tell you, it's, you know, like the SLI is going to tell you, after all, how did you do? What's the measurement of your success at the end? So kind of having both of those helps out.
I think another thing that I remember from the past days, I remember when I worked at a young startup called Cloudify that was about to offer a cloudification of different stacks and automation and things like that. So, but many others that I worked with along my years, there's always been a tension, has always been this tension between the flexibility that engineers like or passionate about and care about, and the simplicity that on the other hand they love not worrying about. And when I came to build out platforms as a product manager, as an engineer, and in companies that I worked with, we always tried to walk this fine line between, on the one hand, providing simplicity, on the other hand, trying to provide more flexibility, because our users are engineers after all. And it always shifted throughout the history. So we talked about the Heroku period and these periods which are more opinionated, and look at Kubernetes or Terraform that allows you to do essentially expose everything to you and you can do whatever you want. But some engineers now start complaining about being cognitively tired because of so many options and needing to keep track of all these when it's actually just the infrastructure and that's not their actually main task. So I'm wondering how you find striking the right balance between flexibility and simplicity in your platform.
Yeah, well, it's important because cognitive overload is one of the major things in those kind of cross-functional roles. So, you know, platform engineers, of course, I joke about, you know, DevOps talking to each other and they become platform engineers. But essentially, platform engineers are usually coming from a software background because you want to build the product. It's not just automations here or there. So you want someone who is a good coder, understands architecture, and then starts understanding different cloud providers, Kubernetes, Vault, Terraform, Ansible, Prometheus, you know, all those kind of different things. And so this kind of brings a lot of complexity to the team. So again, in the team, we are trying to build expertise. So, you know, you have the team that builds the secrets management service. You have the teams that build the observability solutions. You have the teams that build the API gateway solution. So you kind of try to narrow down the focus as much as you can. And this helps build expertise. This helps, you know, this also helps a lot of people. We've had people wanting to keep this focus when we ask them if they want to change, because this brings also expertise and this can help them out with their career in the long term. So, you know, instead of having someone who is, you know, one of the platform engineers, someone who is the observability expert, and then he can go out and you know, be really, really good at this specific thing. So platform engineering is a really dangerous place for cognitive overload. But then, you know, on the other hand, there are kind of solutions for that, and mainly keep teams focused and try to break down the platform in smaller subsystems if you can.
Okay, but my question is actually more on the product engineers for which your users, essentially the platform's users, and users, again, being engineers, some of them very senior, some of them very opinionated on what they like or don't like to do, and each one wants to have control in doing them their own way, and very sensitive of you taking some of these controls from them. But on the other hand, they complain about cognitive overload, saying, hey, you want me to know Kubernetes, you want me to know Terraform, you want me to know this and that, and that's just the boilerplate, I want to do my day job. So I was wondering, in terms of the platform that you build for these users, for the product engineers, how you find a way to strike the balance between their desire to have the flexibility to do it their way with all the control and their desire for you to take offload from them and provide effective abstractions and simplification for them not to have to bother about all of these?
Well, again, the you know, I think it's a good balance between the platform as product and the ad hoc work. So building the platform in a way where you can facilitate different architecture, different implementation styles, those kind of things, is gonna go a big way. You don't want to go to the other side because you're just gonna be a DevOps engineer for this person who is strongly opinionated. So you know, having a platform that kind of can be flexible in that sense, but then also having, again, the soft skills, being able to talk it through. You know, platform engineers as well are really strongly opinionated. So if you have a strongly opinionated person in the product engineering team, then this creates a you know, some big friction over there. But if you have the right soft skills and you're able to sit down and understand, you know, nobody is you know, just stubborn about it. We are strongly opinionated usually because there's some reasoning behind it. So if we kind of go through the reasoning and we understand why each of us is strongly opinionated, then we can end up in a solution that kind of works for both.
So how do you find the right level of abstraction in your platform?
Well, that's a good question. So I would say it's, you know, again, I keep on saying that a lot. It's a lot about this balance. So, you know, we build the service. We try to kind of keep this service as generic as possible, and having the service, you know, following the principle that this service is built in Citrix, but if logs could take it, then they could just use it as it is right away. So if we build it in such a low level. And of course, then on top of that, you can build some integrations, you can build a few other things. Then you can probably have this abstraction. You can have it in a low enough level where you can add this abstraction layer for each product team. And that's you know, kind of the last mile work you're going to have to do.
And I think part of what you touched upon, maybe in part of your answers, was this line between the platform and the product or app, the application. So where does that line draw? And I think you gave a very good sort of rule of thumb that you use, like if it's reusable, but maybe you can, you will describe it better than me.
Yeah. So yeah, the idea is that, you know, if you build something for one team, then it's something you shouldn't be building. That's something the team should be building on their own. As we said, you know, it's something maybe the SRE should be building. But usually, if you look at the higher level problem, the teams are going to say, I have too much toil because I manually rotate secrets and certificates. And that's, you know, you focus on the business problem. Every team is experiencing the same thing. So you are going to focus on providing a solution, a generic solution for that problem. Then there is some extra work in order for you to kind of do the last mile and integrate the service to their business logic. And that's where, you know, oftentimes, you know, the platform team might have to do that in order to convince for adoption, but usually it's the work that the product team should do.
Yeah. And that goes back to what we talked about, at least where I see in the DevOps maturity models, the place where I think is a good clear flag, the repeatability. When you see that it's the very same problem or pattern, a generalized pattern, repeating again and again, this is a signal, okay, DevOps can take care of that or SRE, but this is a good signal. Maybe here is a place where a platform engineering can fit in. So I think that repeatability is a good signal for that.
And that's kind of, you know, that's, I remember the days when I started understanding the value of platform. You know, a few years ago, I was doing some contract work, you know, like a few different startups, different companies, fixed term contracts, 6 months at each company. And you work, you know, like for five of them. And, you know, it's actually the exact same work in every single one of them. And you're like, okay, but why shouldn't they solve their problems in the exact, you know, why don't they use just the product to solve the problems? It's the same thing. And that's where you start to understand. If you work long enough as a DevOps, I think you start understanding why you need platform engineering.
Yeah, unless you make a good living out of just having your own toolbox internally and just selling it again and again as a service.
You could have like your Terraform module, your Ansible playbooks, and just repeat it again and again.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think actually that, you know, Spotify's engineering seems to lead by example in these fields. And they're amazing by sharing their DevOps journey in their blog and things like that. I still remember their blog on golden paths as the way to solve fragmentation in their software stack. So I'm wondering, golden paths, I think you mentioned that in one of your answers briefly, but golden paths are essential for platform engineering because the platform engineering essentially takes the paths and makes them into a tool, a formalized platform. So what are the golden paths that your team promotes and how do you even strike these gold paths?
Yeah, so golden paths is you know, it has been one of the good discussion points over the past couple of years. And there was this blog, I think it was 2020 from Spotify, and Red Hat is also really good on that. And you know, it's so golden paths are a bit of a more opinionated approach, and that's why I think you should always kind of make them optional. So, you know, you should focus on business value that, you know, I want this level of security standards for the release you're doing, or I want, you know, this CIS score in your machine images, whatever that might be. So you should focus on the end state, what the business requirement is, and then you should build the golden path to facilitate the state. But the narrative usually should be, I want this end result. I give you the option of the golden path. If you want to go out there and do your thing, and that's it. If you put on mandates with golden paths in the team and you make them mandatory for everyone, no matter what, then you're gonna get even more friction.
But then again, you do, you know, ultimate freedom is also a problem. So the platform does provide some sort of a paved supported path, which usually represents the golden path. So how do you do that? How do you navigate between this freedom and the paved supported path?
Well, I think the easiest way to connect between, you know, this is the best way for the end result and people thinking that I'm going to do my thing and I'm going to have the end result on my own is going back to you know, collecting data and making the right business case. You know, if you want someone to, and this was the example you remembered from our discussion, you know, if you want someone constantly patching on their own images every time a vulnerability comes up, and they do it manually. And then you can actually present a golden pipeline where hardened images and provide this pipeline, this path to end up with, you know, good CIS benchmark scores, those kind of things. And you do it for everyone, then they're going to get a lot of toil. They're going to get a lot of toil out of the way. So putting in these data points and making sure they understand the why, the golden path is going to help them better than doing their thing. That's gonna make a difference.
So you don't mandate the golden path, but first you say this is the path that I support. That's one, and you can not use it. But if you use that, you offload because I'm taking care of it for you, and you also quantify and show the benefit of using that that supported path, right?
Yeah, and similar to the, you know, as we talk about platform as product, similar, there are different levels of implementation for each golden path. So, you know, you can have no golden path, you can have what we call paths as templates, and you can have paths as products. So you can end up having golden paths as a product, which is going to be, you know, maybe your release pipeline, and it's going to be adopted similar as the platform as product. So going out there, getting requirements, and then getting adoption from the team. But you could also have the middle approach, which is paths as templates, where, you know, someone wants to adopt best practices observability. You can provide a Terraform template or a Terraform module, and they have the option to kind of add configuration, do it on their own. It's not part, you know, it's not something you're giving as a product. It's something they can kind of clone. I think Red Hat calls that, they call it clone and forget. So you kind of develop the template, and, you know, each team clones it and you forget about it. They do their thing. So you provide something which is close to a golden path, but everyone can deviate as they want.
Yeah, makes sense. And you touched a bit upon, you mentioned observability. So we are, after all, in open observability talk. So let's talk about observability and platform engineering, because you gave examples from rotating certificates, from the images, but observability is something that is higher level. It's not just tooling. You have the dashboarding, mm-hmm. you have alerting. So in these aspects, it's not just enough to provide a suite of maybe two supported tools. You need to promote best practices around that. So can you tell us a bit more about observability and platform engineering as you practice it in your team?
Yeah, so observability is a really good example of where a golden path can actually make a difference. So, you know, observability, as you rightly said, starts with, you know, simply adopting logs, metrics, alerts, traces, all those kind of things. And then it has to do with the intelligent part, what you actually, you know, what you actually derive out of this information. It has to do with the visualization. How do you see this information? And also it has to do with leadership. How do you report this information? How do you convert this to SLIs? How do you feed back into your development lifecycle with error budgets? So it's a really long path where you can do things in each step in many different ways. So observability is a really good path to kind of standardize and provide these best practices. We've done some work in observability as code, alerting as code, those kind of things. We're doing some work on SLIs, and we're doing some work on specific SLIs around specific customer groups, specific geos, and kind of measuring and feedback back to the customer experience, and try to measure specific customer experience for cloud customers. And that's a really important part of the platform. That has been a really important part of my life as well.
I can say personally that I heard you speaking. We were together at Open Source Summit, and you had a fascinating talk where you shared about what you built there, the platform that you helps facilitating the SLOs and so on. So it was for me an excellent example. If you want to put a teaser for that one.
As we spoke there at the Open Source Summit, I think SLOs is something where, as you grow an engineering population in a company, you can do it in many different ways, and it's something you kind of have to have standards around. That's why I keep on saying that you have to have these golden paths, and that's the point where the platform can facilitate observability in order to promote the golden path, but also observability can facilitate the platform in order to provide insights in the platform about, you know, availability, pain points about around the team. If you see, you know, if you correlate outages related to, and I'm going to say again, secrets management or certificates expiration, then you know that you get this feedback from observability and you can prioritize differently in your backlog and so on. So relationship between platform and observability is a really close one. And you know, if you build this relationship and data flows from one to the other, then that can start making a big difference.
And ultimately, even if you know, most of us don't, the end engineers don't run the infrastructure usually, especially in the large organization, but they are ultimately responsible for the end-to-end result. Not to mention if you use third parties like cloud vendors and so on, and you have different services on the platform, and you have the on-call, you have different actually on-calls for the platform, on-call for the app. So it can become in an organization this scale. I'm sure also at Citrix, I've seen it in other organizations that you need to start having the standardization also allows the different teams to talk to each other in case of an incident investigation and be able to tailor it end to end. So is that something that you've experienced?
Yeah, and you know it's exactly as you said. So you probably get an alert, you know, in case something happens, you get an alert and you have an SRE who is on call for the product team, and then he starts investigating and he sees that it's an infrastructure problem and he escalates, and you know, the platform SRE is going to get the platform on call person is going to get an alert, and then you're going to start investigating. So, you know, drilling down, you have this so many layers. You know, you have the cloud infrastructure, you have platform infrastructure, you have SaaS engineering, and then you start having the product layers. And as we've moved to microservices, these layers are again many different layers. So you have to be able somehow to drill down and find, you know, go through the five whys and understand the root cause of the problem. And observability is going to help you do exactly that.
Yeah. And I think beyond that, there's the, I guess you had then, you mentioned, I think, one of the points that you emphasized is the doing things as code to be able to instill it within the organization across the teams. Can you share a bit how you managed to create this culture of, I don't know, metrics as code, Terraform? I think even you mentioned synthetics, a bit about these practices that you encourage.
Well, so the biggest two, I would say, I would choose alerting as code and most recently the synthetics as code. They come back to creating the business case. So, you know, the team worked on building some repeatable solutions and solve the problems. Synthetics can be cumbersome in order to develop again and again, different user journeys, different clicks, different outside in monitoring. So you have to recreate all these different components. And then you also have the infrastructure part. So you have to cover different geos, different customer groups, different entitlements, all those kind of things. So having a single team focusing on automating this, and then when a new product team's when each product team just adds new feature, creates a configuration file, and that automatically generates the customer user journey in the background. So you kind of see the value. And when engineers are doing again and again things that they don't want to do, like writing, you know, different customer user journey, different scripted browser, and so on, it's really easy to convince them, you know, you're going to have to create this configuration file. It's going to work like this. And this is going to create the user journey, which works like this. The infrastructure, you know, does this and this and that. And at the end of the day, you're going to get the SLIs for this user journey in the dashboard. Then, you know, all of a sudden that provides a lot of, that gives them back a lot of their effort.
Great. I think we're coming to the end of the episode, although I could talk to you about this topic for another hour easily. But I want to maybe share with the audience how they can follow you, where they can reach you if they have any questions or they want to read or hear more about your thoughts about the topic?
Yeah, sure. So anyone who is in Germany is going to be able to see me live in open source monitoring. We're going to be together there at OSMC in Nuremberg.
That's
going to be a good opportunity. Again, there we're going to talk about how we can scale SLOs with Kubernetes and cloud native observability. Other than that, LinkedIn and Twitter are the platforms I'm on. We can share in the comments or the chat my connections, and anyone can follow there. I usually try and share my conference slides, any nice thing I find. So that's the best place to see how I'm thinking.
Yeah, and I definitely like the things that you're. I started tagging you on interesting conversations that I'm part of, so that's a cool thing. And maybe just to mention that you're working on an interesting book, so it's worthwhile also following you to hear more about that as more details will be revealed. And your insights about platform engineering, huh?
Yeah, we have some work ahead of us, but I'm going to be making some announcement about. I was doing a research, and there's no other book in platform engineering out there, like the structure of it, how it should work, all those kind of things. So we're in this journey now, and we're going to be able to say more soon.
Yeah, stay tuned. That's it should be fascinating. So trust me, you want to follow George and hear more about that. So I want to thank you very much. And we didn't leave too much time this time around for the breaking news, but it's fine. I think we used made best use of the time for this. So I want to thank you again, George, for joining me on this fascinating episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And of course, I would like to thank all the audience, the listeners, for being with us for this episode. As always, all the episodes are available on the favorite or your favorite podcast app or on YouTube. So do chime in there. We stream. If you are listening on the podcast app, then do know that we stream the episodes live on YouTube and Twitch. So follow us on Twitter to hear where the next live stream is. And you can chime in. It makes it much more fun because you can ask questions and make your comments. You can find all the details on the website, openobservability.io. And follow us on Twitter at OpenObserve for updates. Or you can follow me at Horvitz. And you'll be updated on what's going on. You can also share your comments, suggestions, news bits, and so on. And if you have something interesting to share, if you're an expert in your domain, then do submit a talk proposal on openobservability.io. There's an open CFP there. Thank you very much for listening, and see you on next month's episode.